Good morning. First case for oral argument this morning is Alfred Jennings et al. Appellants v. Rapid City Regional Hospital Appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Reed Richards, an attorney from Spearfish. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Daniel Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City. The court would like to welcome students from, I understand, Sully Buttes High School, is that correct? And the teacher, Mr. Cheekwin. Welcome, and I hope you find this educational process. With that, Mr. Richards, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I represent the appellant Pope and Talbot employees from the Pope and Talbot Spearfish Mill. And Mr. Daniel Duffy represents the Pelley Rapid City Regional Hospital Systems Incorporated. This appeal involves a health care plan that Pope and Talbot had for its employees. The employees would have a little bit of a deduction off of each of their checks, and they would have this coverage. Pope and Talbot was self-insured, and in order to carry that process out, they had to hire or have a contract with a company called First Choice Midwest, which was just the administrator of the health care plan. So they had a contract with First Choice, which is shown on Exhibit A of our first brief. First Choice, in turn, had a contract with Rapid City Regional Hospital Systems, and that contract is Exhibit B of our first brief. Now, in those contracts, the relationship is set forth, and I'm paraphrasing just a little bit, in that the contracts talk about members, which it means the employees, but in the contract between Pope and Talbot and First Choice Midwest, it says that this is a contractual relationship wherein Pope and Talbot obtains medical services for its employees. And then in the First Choice Midwest contract with Regional, it says, Regional Hospital will provide health care services to eligible employees. So this is how the arrangement went. And then in November of 2007, Pope and Talbot declared bankruptcy. Now, after that point, the relationship continued. Payments continued to be made by Pope and Talbot for medical services from Regional. And the deductions on the employees' checks continued. However, when the Pope and Talbot Mill was sold out of bankruptcy in May of 2008, then those payments stopped. At that point, there were some residual medical payments that were due Rapid City Regional for services that had been provided to the employees. And that amounted to quite a bit of money in some cases, tens of thousands of dollars.
Now, this would have been after they came out of bankruptcy?
These were payments that continued throughout the bankruptcy. Like they would have maybe started in October of 2007 and still been.
Would the hospital have known that they were not being paid by Pope and Talbot at that point?
In May?
I guess my question is this. I'm trying to get the time frame. If the payments, they continued making payments, you said, and then they quit making payments to the hospital when they came out of bankruptcy, so when would the hospital have known that Pope and Talbot wasn't making these payments?
Well,
way after they sold it, or what?
They would have been aware before that, and this isn't in the record or anything, but the employees had conferences with Pope and Talbot. Pope and Talbot, you know, told Midwest told Rapid City Regional and so forth that they were in bankruptcy, and then through that period from November to May, Pope and Talbot said, you know, get your bills in, get them paid, because we're going to stop paying as soon as the company is sold.
Okay, but then what happened is that when they started charging then the employees after
May.
After May. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
So there's no covered services at issue other than what? Other than when? All arising before May, between November and May, or after May, or
the amounts that are in issue, Your Honor?
Yes.
These would be bills that would have been incurred for medical services, some probably even prior to November of 2007, some incurred after 2007, and most of these bills, I think it'd be fair to say, maybe partial payments have been made by Pope and Talbot, but the full amount hadn't been approved by Midwest and their bureaucratic process for approval of medical services for the employees and improvement of the payment.
So were there medical services incurred after May of 08?
No.
Okay, so all right. So it's only before the payments were actually stopped by Pope and Talbot that we're talking about. We're talking about claims that are made before the payments were stopped.
Correct.
Okay.
These are...
But wait a minute. They weren't paying all the claims, though, were they? Before the sale?
Your Honor, I think that, yes. I think the way this would work is, as I mentioned, a kind of a bureaucratic process. Employee goes in and has some procedure or something, and the bill comes to First Choice Midwest. They look around and say, well, is this really necessary, and you know, blah, 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 and so they go back and talk to the patient. And eventually, in the normal course of things, First Choice says to Pope and Talbot, yep, it's an allowable bill, go ahead and pay it. But in that process, see, that was still ongoing on some of these bills in May of 2008 when Pope and Talbot said, well, or the trustee in bankruptcy said, hey, we're done.
But it was for bills all incurred before May of 08.
Correct. Okay. Yeah, that is correct. Okay. Yeah, at that time that the new company took over.
This arrangement between Pope and Talbot, First Choice, and then the hospital as a provider, was that a managed care entity, or was that a managed care entity, or whatever you'd call it, that's regulated by the insurance, Department of Insurance?
That I can't answer. I'm not sure what the nature of that would be from the Department of Insurance viewpoint.
And that never came up.
No. The best I can answer is what I mentioned to you before in the exhibit in the contract between First Choice and Regional is just that Regional will provide health care services for the employees that are eligible. Eligible employees would basically be employees that are working for Pope and Talbot and paying their little deductibles out of each check.
Does it fall under the statute as a managed care plan? Is that the...
I just can't answer that. All right. I don't know. If a managed care plan would be exclusive, that they'd handle all of the health care needs of... possibly, because Regional is a big corporation. It has both, you know, your primary physicians and your hospitals. It has the clinics and Spearfish and so.
Well, I guess that came to mind because in the undisputed facts presented by the defendant, they indicated that FCM was a managed care entity and certified under Chapter 470304 of the Administrative Rules of South Dakota.
The way we view it and present it and the way we understand, FMC, the First Choice Midwest, is an administrative body that puts the employee in connection with the provider for the employees. That's the best I can answer that question, I guess. So what we're left with in terms of the circumstances is we have these contracts, these two contracts, very similar, which, of course, the employees did not sign. So one of the issues in this matter is, are the employees a third-party beneficiary to these two contracts? And, of course, we're asserting that they are. We have, In terms of that, we have state law 53-2-6, which reads, a contract made expressly for the benefit of a third person may be enforced by him at any time before the parties thereto rescind it. Now, we think that it's very clear that these contracts that we're talking about were made for the benefit of the employees, because if they weren't made for the benefit of the employees, they wouldn't be necessary. In other words, if Pope and Talbot wasn't going to provide health care services for the employees, there wouldn't be any of these contracts.
Now, you had summary judgment granted against your clients, correct?
That is correct.
Are you saying there's any questions of fact here, or are you saying you win as a matter of law?
This is a matter of law.
All right. So there's nothing to go back and try.
I'm sorry?
There's nothing to go back and try.
That is correct.
All right.
We're asking the court to take a de novo look.
The situation. If we were to agree with you, then let me ask you this. Was the second part of your issue, or the second part that came up, that actually the employees were obligated under the admission form, terminology into the admission form, was that, I had a difficult time figuring out how the court really addressed that, or if the court even addressed that part of it.
All that the trial court said on that would be that, as I understand it, and read the court's decision, was that they would be liable under that, because under that admissions document, because it formed a separate obligation.
But then there was some discussion of adhesion.
Yes, ma'am.
And the court just sort of dismissed that, saying that, well, that would be a defense. So I guess my question was that part litigated?
Yes, it was a part of our argument, the adhesion argument.
But the court doesn't address whether it is or isn't.
It really doesn't. That is correct. That's correct. And we believe that's an important argument because the document is, frankly, if I may say so, a strange document if it's supposed to be a contract. It's a form contract, and it says hospital. It doesn't say regional hospital, Rapid City Regional, anything like that. And it goes on and says you're going to be treated by some people, employees of the hospital, and then you'll be treated by some people that aren't employees of the hospital and don't have any legal connection with us. But, you know, we're throwing them all in here anyway. And then on top of that, it says, you know, the employee has to sign it, but the hospital doesn't sign it anywhere, and there's just a witness to it. And I would submit to the court, if we had a lawyers had a fee agreement like this, just saying the law office, you're going to have to pay the law office, and you might have to pay some of the employees of the law office, you might have to pay some other employees or other people that are independent contractors in the law office, so forth, it wouldn't be a valid contract. This is not a valid contract for that purpose, for saying that you've got to pay for these medical services. And on top of that, if you were to say that this consent to treatment is an enforceable contract, well, isn't it really then an amendment or an attempted amendment to the contract shown in Exhibits A and B between Regional and the Pope and Talbot?
Wouldn't there be some question? I mean, you're saying that this is a question of law, but in reality, if we're going to get to the second part of it, this admission form and whether it's adhesion or whatever, and some of the things that you're arguing, aren't these questions of fact that were not dealt with? Doesn't the court have to make some findings on how this is submitted to the patient, what the patient knows? Wouldn't you have to have some testimony in as far as what they, how this was given to them, what they were required to do? I mean, normally with a contract, for, when it's challenged for adhesion, you do have some fact-based decisions to be made by the trial court. There was none here on that issue.
That is correct, Your Honor. But we would submit that the court, just looking at the face of this document and looking at the other undisputed facts in this case, could determine that by the terms of this agreement, it is a contract of adhesion. For instance, in the Nygaard versus Sioux City or Sioux Valley Hospital that this court has decided, you say the court looks not only at the bargaining power between the parties, but also at the specific terms of the agreement. And you look at the specific terms of the agreement here. There's no bargaining, nothing here. This is you. If you want your broken leg fixed, here, sign here. If you don't sign it, you don't get any services. That's even in disregard of the contract that Pope and Talbot has with Regional. It's just actually just a form that they treat as just a form until the bankruptcy comes along, and then they say, oh, here, you've got to pay because of this. Before that point, they don't say, this is an important contract obligating you to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars if Pope and Talbot doesn't pay.
See, you're running out of time. I'd like to get to the trial court's rationale here. The trial court said that a condition precedent wasn't fulfilled because Pope and Talbot didn't pay on its contract. Therefore, there's no contract for your employee clients to enforce. What is your response to that?
We don't believe that's the correct interpretation of the situation. The Pope and Talbot was paying all the way through until May of 2008. It didn't get all of them paid. That's why we're here. The contract says that it's a valid contract until the parties give notice to each other, hey, you aren't meeting the terms of the contract, you know, you're in default. That never happened. So I think our position is that the contract was valid right up through May of 2008. The employees were eligible, therefore, right up to May of 2008. In fact, I'm sure the record would show that they were getting health care services in April 2008. So that, you know, that's something that can be brought up in some contract, but in this case, we don't think so.
Okay. Did the bankruptcy trustee reject the contract? Did the bankruptcy trustee do anything with respect to these contracts? Normally in a bankruptcy, you know, they accept or reject contracts.
Right. As far as I know, Your Honor, they did not, other than to apparently authorize payments up until May of 2008. And then at that point, then they stopped. The basic nature of this complaint that we're dealing with here today, or this appeal, is found in these contracts. I keep coming back to them because I think they're very important. I think they govern what we're talking about here. And in each of these contracts is a paragraph which says, and I'm paraphrasing again just a little bit, the employees shall not be liable for any charges for health care services that are covered services. Okay. And that means any health care services that Pope and Talbot should pay. The employees are not going to be liable for that. So if the employees are third-party beneficiaries, which we think they are, because this contract was expressly made for the employees, then the employees are saying to the court, we want that paragraph honored. We don't want to be done for tens of thousands of dollars of past bills that Pope and Talbot should have paid but didn't because of the bankruptcy. They're saying, basically, that, you know, it's unfortunate, but Rapid City Regional has to bite the bullet just like all the other creditors of Pope and Talbot under these circumstances.
Now, these bills that your clients received directly, did they go through FCM?
No. When, well, excuse me, ma'am. In terms of the the normal course of events?
Right. Normally, under that agreement, they would have gone to FCM. FCM would have looked at them, indicated whether or not they were payable under that agreement with the provider.
Right.
Were these direct bills to your employees, did they go through FCM to determine whether or not they were met the requirements that they with the agreement with the provider?
My understanding is, and I believe the record would show, that let's say one of the employees had a $1,000 bill at Regional as of May 2008. The next thing that would have happened would have been a phone call from their collection agency saying, you owe this $1,000 pay up.
So the record doesn't reflect where they whether or not they attempted to put them through FCM.
Yeah, I would suggest, and this is just, I'm sorry, speculation, that after May of 2008, FCM didn't have anything more to do with the billing process.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Your time has expired. Mr. Depp, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, Chief Justice Gilbertson. I suppose the best way for me to start is to address some of the issues that the court has already raised with Mr. Richards. Justice Meyer-Henry, one of the questions that you asked about was the consent to treatment form and whether or not it was actually addressed by the trial court. And in fact, if you look at page 8 of Judge Macy's decision, Judge Macy actually did address the issue of the adhesion contract allegation.
But he mainly says adhesion can be raised as a defense.
Sure.
But this never went to that point where it could be raised as a defense and dealt with.
And it didn't.
He just automatically ruled for you on that.
And I think the reason is if you even look at the case law was cited by the appellants in this case, the Wheeler decision, and I think that's one of the seminal cases dealing with adhesion contracts, that I'm not able to find a court that has ever said that in a healthcare context that when you go in and sign a form, a consent to treatment and condition of admission form, that it is an adhesion contract as to the payment of the medical bills that you have incurred. Many courts have addressed it in the context of whether or not it's an adhesion contract if it contains a mandatory arbitration provision or if it limits your tort remedies against the healthcare entity. But there, I've not found a case either in South Dakota or outside South Dakota in which a court has used an adhesion contract analysis to say that you are when you go in, you knowingly receive healthcare services. And frankly, even in the absence of a written agreement, you would be understood to be obligated to pay those. So I think in this context, there were no disputed facts, and there was no law that was cited to suggest that once they signed that agreement, that they weren't obligated to pay the medical bills. And Justice Meyer-Henry, you raised a point about the disputed issues of or the issues of material fact, and I think that is an important issue in this case because we have to deal with the settled record that was created, and there was no Rule 56F motion made to supplement the record with any additional information. But if you look at the issues of material fact number 17 stated, these are ours. These are the material facts brought forth by the defendants. Material fact number 22 states, plaintiffs, their spouses, and dependents also entered into consent to treatment and conditions of admissions at Rapid City Regional Hospital with a citation to the affidavits with a list of all of the consents to treatment. The plaintiffs, the appellants in this case, admitted to that material fact. So they've essentially, and they raised on appeal the issue of those consent to treatment forms, but it was an issue that they actually conceded to the trial court that they signed them, that they were consents to treatment, and that they involved Rapid City Regional Hospital. That issue was really essentially raised now before this court in a manner that was never, ever addressed in front of the trial court.
Let me ask you about the managed care plan and whether or not that was regulated by the Department of Insurance. It looks like a managed care plan. FCM is licensed and on the website is a licensed care entity. Is this plan... was that, and obviously there are terminologies in the agreement between FCM and the providers and FCM and Polk and Talbot that are similar, i.e. the provision we're dealing with here today.
That's correct.
Is this a managed care plan that's regulated by 5817C?
Yeah, and I think if you look at Michael Haggard's affidavit in this case, which is the affidavit that states that, and it cites actually to Chapter 47 of the administrative rules that it is a managed care organization under the laws of the state of South Dakota.
Okay, then let me ask you this. 5817C14(2) provides that in no event may a participating provider collect or attempt to collect from a covered person any money owed to the provider by the health carrier, nor may the provider have any recourse against covered persons for any covered charges in excess of the copayment, coinsurance, or deductible amounts specified in the coverage, including covered persons who have a health savings account. Why doesn't that apply here?
The reason that it doesn't apply, Your Honor, and I think you raised the issue at one point in your questioning of Mr. Richards, is Rapid City Regional Hospital has an agreement with First Choice of the Midwest, not with the payer in this case. First Choice has an agreement with the payer, which is Pope and Talbot.
But isn't that true of all managed care plans?
If
you have a managed care entity that lines up the providers on the one side and the people who want the insurance or want the... you could have Pope and Talbot self-insured, but you could have an insurance company over here.
That's
too.
Correct.
I mean, isn't that the whole idea of the health care, managed care plan?
It is, and I think...
So they aren't divided. They're a plan.
Right, that's correct. And I think, as you read the statute, what it contemplates is an agreement between the health care provider and the organization, in this case First Choice, which is the PPO, or the Preferred Provider Organization. The Pope and Talbot, and then through them, their employees, receive the benefit of the contractual arrangement between Rapid City Regional Hospital and Pope and Talbot by its agreement to participate as one of the preferred providers. But the terms and conditions, even under the statute, the terms and conditions of that contract still have to be met. And that's where we come back in this case to the issue that I believe Justice Konenkamp raised, which is the issue of a condition precedent.
Well, it doesn't say that. It says in no event may a participating provider collect directly from the covered person.
And I think it has to be...
No recourse.
Well, and it would have to be understood in reading that statute, Your Honor, together with the contract language, that the terms of the preferred provider or managed care agreement would have to actually be satisfied. And in this case, I think what has happened is we've jumped to section 5.05.
Wouldn't it limit their recourse to whoever is supposed to pay? Because that's the agreement. That's the managed care plan. Otherwise, why have a managed care plan? Why have, the whole deal is to line it up so you have better prices, numbers that you can negotiate, and that kinds of things. So I guess I'm confused why, this provision here seems to me to say when your hospital stepped up and signed that agreement, they're covered by the law, and FCM is covered by the law, that in those contracts, it has to say you have to agree. You can't go directly after the covered person. And it says no recourse, any recourse, nor may the provider have any recourse. So I guess why doesn't this apply? I know nobody raised this. But
well, I guess what I would say, Your Honor, the reason is that the by the terms of the agreement that Regional Hospital had, the regional system had with First Choice of the Midwest, they agreed that they would accept the payments that were the discounted payments that were made in their relationship through the contract with First Choice, if those payments were made under 5.01. They agreed they would. And then under 5.02, they said, and they shall accept that as the payment in full for whatever covered services are covered under the terms of the plan. In this case, what we seem to do is be taking those two and setting them aside and jumping to 5.05, in which it says they shall not recover any amounts from the members without actually stating that the predicate provisions of that section of the contract have to be met, which is 5.01 and 5.02. Otherwise, we're left in a situation, even in a managed care context, where if something like this happens, or if they decide not, if the third party entity decides not to pay, any health care provider would be left with no recourse in which to recover directly from the patient.
Okay, but your wouldn't your recourse be to go after the person obligated to pay, which in this case was the company, Hope and Talbot, not against the employees?
And I think in this context, Justice Stevens, regional hospitals didn't have a contract with Hope and Talbot. We didn't. This isn't like the vertical relationship.
Okay, are you now getting into the issue of who's the, is there a third-party beneficiaries to this contract? And reading your brief, as I read it, you were saying that this contract is solely for the benefit economically of the hospital and in the managed care, and it has no benefit to the members who are their employees.
That's correct.
Is that your position?
Well, it's our position because under the settled record in this case, Your Honor, there is no evidence that, even before Pope and Talbot elected to enter into the contract with First Choice, there's no evidence that the employees were ever responsible for payment of any of their health care expenses, that all of those expenses were being paid by Pope and Talbot. So once Pope and Talbot entered into the contract with First Choice, the benefit of reduced health care costs flowed to Pope and Talbot. There's nothing in this record to suggest that either before Pope and Talbot entered into the agreement with First Choice or after they entered into the agreement with First Choice, that there was ever any medical bill or expense liability that would have attached to the employees or their dependents. All of those were always being paid by Pope and Talbot as a self-insured entity. So when you look at the contract that Rapid City Regional had with First Choice, one could suggest that Pope and Talbot was a third-party beneficiary because they received the benefit of Regional's agreement to give them a discount for health care services for all of their employees and dependents. But there's no evidence in the settled record in this case that even in the absence of that agreement, that there would have been any benefit that would have flowed to the employees or their dependents.
Well, the employees were to get health care. That's the reason for the entire agreement, was the health care to the employees.
Actually, no, the reason for the agreement was to discount the payment for those health care services. The employees, by admission in this case, the employees were already going to receive payment for health care services from Pope and Talbot, whether there was an agreement with First Choice of the Midwest or not. So if you were to pull the reference to the members out of the agreement between Regional and First Choice, if you were to pull them out, the agreement would still exist because the agreement was necessary for Pope and Talbot to receive discounts on the payment of their health care services.
Without the members, there wouldn't be any need for it.
But I suppose...
And the hospital gets the benefit of a patient base.
That's correct, but I guess I would suggest, Justice Stevenson, that in any case in which there's a third party, you could, I guess, arguably state that in the absence of those third parties, there may never need to be a reason for the agreement. One of the cases I guess you would look at is kind of the two sides of this is the Cisney case, where you could say in that case, because there was a settlement agreement saying that all prisoners of Jewish faith would receive kosher meals. And then subsequent to that, a Jewish patient said, I fit that category. Therefore, I'm entitled to the benefits of that agreement. I think in that case, where the court found an express third-party beneficiary, if you pulled out that class of persons in that agreement, there would be no agreement at all. So they were, in effect, expressly intended third-party beneficiaries. I don't think you can take that same analysis and apply it here, because you could, in effect, take the members out of just this agreement. They were already going to receive the benefit of health care services through their employment with Pope and Talbot. But if you pulled them out of the agreement between Regional and First Choice, you wouldn't destroy the agreement, because the agreement wasn't expressly intended to benefit the employee. The employee's benefit was health care services that were going to be paid by their employer. There may have been an incidental benefit, but even in this record, it's not clear what that incidental benefit might have been. And I think one of the things that's maybe...
So let me ask you then, is your basis for collection then strictly on the admission form?
It is, Your Honor.
And then let me ask you this. I'm really still bothered by the lack of much fleshing out of that part of it in the record. But if you look at the admission form, you know, yes, there's the one section that says they agree to, or that the undersigned agrees, whether as agent or patient, that in consideration of services rendered, he or she is obligated to pay the account. But then the very next paragraph talks about the undersigned understands that he or she is financially responsible for charges not covered by his health or other insurance plan, unless and then only to the extent that the hospital and these physicians and your health and other insurance providers have otherwise agreed in a contract. I mean, I'd read that and think that I'm covered by my employer's insurance agreement.
And I think, and you,
so, I mean, I guess it does, isn't that form in itself sort of confusing?
Well, I think what you're referring to, Justice Meyer-Henry, is our paragraph 6 and 7 in the consent form. Number 6 is the guarantee that every patient who comes in signs. It says they are going to guarantee that in consideration of the services, they obligate themselves for payment. Paragraph 7 is actually, you read the last sentence, but I think it's important to read the entire paragraph 7, which is it's an assignment of insurance benefit provision. And it really, and I think
these employees were covered by insurance, were they not?
The employees were covered by their employer's self-insured right. responsibilities to pay their healthcare services. So I don't know that, I don't believe it's confusing, Your Honor, because if you read paragraph 7 in its entirety, what it says is, you, by signing this, have assigned the rights. And I think this is not just at regional. This kind of form exists in healthcare truly as a benefit in many cases to patients who come in. Because in the absence of an assignment of insurance benefits to the healthcare provider, healthcare providers would then be saying to patients when they come in, give us your credit card or pay for these services, then you go to your insurance company and get reimbursed. These kinds of paragraphs exist because the patients will come in and they will assign to the healthcare organization the right to go directly to the insurance company to pay those their healthcare expenses. Now, that assignment doesn't mean that they're relieved of the responsibility under paragraph 6, and I think that's what paragraph 7 tries to make clear is we will accept the assignment, but you have still obligated yourself for payment of these health care expenses. It's not a substitution of the insurance company or the self-employed entity for the payment of those. It's simply an assignment by the employee and their family member to the insurance company or other self-insured organization that the hospital has the right to seek collection of those benefits directly from that entity, but not to relieve them of the responsibility to do so.
Any of these bills go through FCM?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that up through May of 2008, when Pope and Talbot converted from a Chapter 11 to a Chapter 7 liquidation bankruptcy, that the process for submission of bills was followed up through that point. And I think that question was raised. I believe all of the bills that were incurred, and I don't think that's in dispute, were incurred prior to May of 2008, and a number of them were incurred prior to November of 2007 of the unpaid bills in this case.
And why weren't they handled in bankruptcy? I think Justice Sinner asked that.
I believe that, and Mr. Richards can certainly speak to this in his rebuttal time, but I believe that almost all of the employees made claims as creditors against Pope and Talbot in the bankruptcy. And how that all washed out in the bankruptcy proceeding, I'm not aware. But that's what was appropriate in this case, because the employees were the ones who were the creditors for these unpaid expenses that their employer was supposed to pay to Regional Hospital, just as it would be if there was an insurance company involved.
Did the hospital make a claim? Are you aware?
I do not believe they did, Your Honor. I don't believe there's any evidence that the hospital was a creditor in the Pope and Talbot bankruptcy.
Let me shift what I think is the essence of the trial court's decision. It looked to me like the trial court relied on the concept of condition precedent. But, you know, I look through these contracts, and I can't find any contractual provision that says there's a condition precedent here.
The words condition precedent don't appear in the contract, but I don't know that one could read the contract between Regional Hospital and First Choice, paragraphs 5.01 and 5.02. I don't know that they could be read any other way except to create a condition precedent. Regional entered into that contract, and that's the very first paragraph in that section stating that, quote, hospital agrees to accept payment as provided in this agreement as payment in full for medically necessary covered health care services rendered to each member and shall not bill member for any balance between hospital's bill charges and the applicable reimbursement rate. So beginning right with that first paragraph in 501, the hospital's agreement was to accept the payment if it's made consistent with the terms of this agreement and the attachment that laid out how it was going to be handled. 5.02 then says, hospital shall be entitled to receive as payment in full for medically necessary covered health care services its bill charges discounted by the rate set out in Exhibit A. I think those two paragraphs together, I think, clearly state what Regional Hospital's agreement was in this, and that is, if they were paid, consistent with the exhibit attached to that contract, they would accept that as payment in full and would not seek to balance bill for any of those charges against the patient.
I don't see, though, that that's any different than any contract provision. I don't see how that is what's unique about that to make that a condition precedent.
I think the reason that it's a condition precedent is because once you get to 5.05, which is the member's liability, which only comes in this contract, comes after those two provisions have been stated, where it says, except as otherwise permitted under applicable law, members shall not be liable for any charges for health care services that are covered services. You go back to the covered services, both in the definitional section and into 02 and into 01, it just seems that the only reasonable interpretation of this contract is that Regional agreed to accept those payments at a discounted payment as long as they were made, and in exchange for that, under 5.05, they would not seek to recover the collection of any of these health care bills directly from the patient.
Your time has expired, Mr. Duffy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Richards, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The conditional precedent argument of counsel, I have difficulty following. The nature of this matter, everything was going fine until the bankruptcy and the stopping of the payments. It's the contract, everybody was happy with the contract, everything was going fine. So it was an ongoing contract up until that point, and the part of these bills had already been paid, part hadn't been. That's what's in dispute. So the condition precedent doesn't seem to fit into that. The counsel's argument that the contract between Regional and Midwest as not being for the employees just flies in the face of what the language is. And I repeat again, in Exhibit B, in the whereases, the first part of the paragraph, it says, Regional Hospital will provide health care services to eligible employees. That's what the contract's about. It's not about discounts or anything like that. I think that's a red herring. Exhibit C of our first brief talks about the discounts. And it says there that these discounts go to Midwest, First Choice of Midwest. That's how they get paid. That's where they get their money for administering this stuff. It's not a benefit to Pope and Talbot. And Pope and Talbot has nothing to do with the discount stuff. Midwest got this agreement so that they would handle the health care policy for Pope and Talbot, and they got payment from the hospital in return for that. And the Pope and Talbot just paid the bills that Midwest told them to pay.
But doesn't the whole plan presuppose that Pope and Talbot is going to be paying for the plan? You're saying that Pope and Talbot can stop paying for the plan and everything else has to continue on. Isn't there a presupposition here that if someone isn't paying for the plan stops?
No, Your Honor, we aren't saying that Pope and Talbot has to, or that the hospital has to continue under all these circumstances. Nobody wanted Pope and Talbot to go bankrupt and stop paying, but that's what happened. Under the bankruptcy laws, they don't have to pay anymore. The employees are just an unsecured creditor. The hospital is just an unsecured creditor. And they don't get anything. So what we have to do, though, is look and see under the contract as it existed, as it was signed, as payments were made over a period of years, who is responsible under those circumstances? And we're saying, well, it's not the employees. The paragraph says that they aren't going to be liable for these payments that Pope and Talbot is supposed to be making. So it's just a simple situation where, okay, where does the loss fall in a bankruptcy? Well, we're saying it doesn't fall to the employees. They weren't supposed to pay for that under any circumstances, under any normal circumstances. So we're saying, well, I'm sorry, hospital, but you're just like a lot of other people out in Spearfish that got stuck with bills that weren't paid for by Pope and Talbot. It's a very straightforward argument that we have. I indicated in our brief the analogy to, let's say, Pope and Talbot having an agreement with a gas station, a local gas station, where the employees could go and fill up the cars and sign that they filled up the gas, and Pope and Talbot pay the gas company. And then when bankruptcy comes, does the gas company have any basis for going after each employee that filled up and under that agreement? No. Unfortunately, they're a creditor that gets stuck. So basically what we're concerned about and what we want to have the court do is send this back to the trial court with instructions to give us a permanent injunction against any collection efforts on these bills that Pope and Talbot should have paid and didn't, and give us a permanent injunction on that. And that's basically what we're after, so that they don't have to try to pay these burdensome, some of them are very burdensome amounts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.